Wonderful. Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be able to speak to you tonight. And please excuse me that I must address you in English. My high school French is very poor. And I want to express very deep thanks to Professor Boll and Professor Barringer and all of their staff at the Institut Villet and also the university here for the wonderful hospitality. It's been a real pleasure to be here, so thank you very much. I've provided you with a written summary of my remarks, and you should see on the second page also some text, but please don't start reading that yet. I do hope that those notes help you to follow my lecture, despite my Australian accent. Can you understand me? Yes? No? Good. So my topic is the Brexit case, which was, as you know, decided by the UK Supreme Court earlier this week. And my goal is to offer a comparative perspective on it. And as I will explain shortly, I will seek to present for your consideration both an insider and an outsider perspective on the case. The decision of a majority of United Kingdom voters to support Britain's withdrawal from the European Union was one of the most important events of last year. Britain's withdrawal not only has very immediate implications for the people of Britain and the peoples of Europe, it will also have significant ramifications for people throughout the world. In a recent speech outlining her government's policies in relation to Brexit, British Prime Minister Theresa May made clear that, while she wanted Britain to continue to engage positively and constructively with Europe, her vision for Britain's future was a global one. In her speech, she specifically mentioned India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, China, Brazil, and the Gulf states as countries with which Britain would pursue new and renewed trading relationships. While that's still a selective list of countries, it seems that Brexit has implications for us all. We're all interested in Brexit, but our perspectives on it differ, not only on account of our attitudes to politics, economics, and the European project, but also on account of where we live, whether we live in Britain, whether we live in one of the other member states of the EU, or outside of Europe altogether. So it seemed appropriate for me as an outsider to the EU, but as an insider within the British Commonwealth of Nations, to offer you an insider-outsider account of the Brexit case. So let me start from the insider point of view. Would that be better? Okay. So my insider perspective is shaped by certain... Is that creating feedback now? I think the other one might be better. Okay. Is that better? Okay. So my insider perspective is shaped by certain constitutional institutions and understandings which Australians share with the United Kingdom. I'm thinking here of our shared Westminster heritage. I'm thinking here in particular of the Westminster institutions, the particular kinds of parliamentary government systems that evolved in Britain and were passed on in modified form to the British colonies throughout the world. This is a system of government which distinguishes sharply between the executive prerogative powers that are, as a matter of strict constitutional law, vested exclusively in the Queen, and the political conventions that regulate the exercise of those powers by the Queen. The ancient prerogatives of the Queen include the power to conduct international relations, to declare war and make peace, and to conclude international agreements. As one distinguished British judge once put it, the international prerogatives of the Crown include the power not only to negotiate and to conclude international treaties, but also to construe them and observe them, as well as to breach, repudiate, and terminate them. The giving of notice under a treaty, such as the giving of notice of an intention to withdraw from the European Union under Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union, would thus ordinarily fall within the prerogatives of the Crown. But as extensive as the prerogatives of the Crown may be, the constitutional conventions of Westminster Parliamentary Government require that the Queen exercise those powers on the advice of Ministers of State who have the confidence of the lower house of the Parliament, the House of Commons. This means that the international prerogatives vested formally in the Queen are exercised on the advice of the Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary in a manner that is ultimately accountable to Parliament. Moreover, the Parliament is, as a matter of fundamental British law, sovereign. It is able to enact statutes that bind the Crown, controlling the exercise of the prerogative, abrogating, regulating, or replacing the powers of the Crown in any respect that it wishes. Further, it is also a principle of British law that the prerogatives of the Crown cannot be used to annul, dispense, or suspend the operation of statutes enacted by the Parliament. Parliament is sovereign, and the law that it enacts and the rights that it creates cannot be abrogated by the Crown, even in the exercise of its ancient prerogatives. These basic principles of British constitutional law are acknowledged by everyone. So what was the Brexit case about? In essence, it concerned the domestic requirements of British law, British constitutional law, relating to the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the European Union. Article 50, as I'm sure many of you will know, and I might try and bring it up on the screen. Hang on, where's the page up and down?
Use the arrows, maybe.
Arrows?
Yeah.
Aha, sorry about that. So, as you know, Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union provides that a member state which decides, in accordance with its own constitutional requirements, to withdraw from the Union, to notify the European Council of its intention to do so. And the giving of the notice, as you could see from this extract from the article, has several important consequences. First, it sets up a process of negotiation between the member state and the European Union to determine the arrangements for the withdrawal of the member state and the framework for its future relationship with the Union. Second, Article 50 mandates that such withdrawal will occur either on the date of entry into force of the agreement that's formed, or failing that, 2 years after the notification is given, that is, unless a member state and the European Council unanimously decide to extend the period. And just incidentally, I note that there is some dispute about whether, after notice is given, withdrawal of the member state is definitely inevitable, or whether prior to that, a member state might revoke the notice and decide to remain in the Union. The question in the Brexit case concerned the requirements of British law for the giving of such notice under Article 50. There was a second set of arguments in the case about the effect of British devolution, about whether the governments and the parliaments of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland would also have to be consulted and give their consent to the giving of notice under Article 50. But the main question concerned the UK as a whole, and that's where my focus will lie. Is the Queen, in effect the government of the day, able to give the Article 50 notice simply in exercise of the royal prerogative? Or must such notification first be approved by the Parliament? That was the question. And just to be clear, there's no dispute about whether, in the absence of any relevant parliamentary statute, the UK government would be able to issue the notice in the name of the Queen. The question in the Brexit case was whether any of the several British statutes dealing with Britain's membership in the EU somehow regulated the prerogative so that parliamentary approval would be required. And so first we have to turn to those statutes and understand what they say. The most prominent one is the European Communities Act of 1972, which was enacted by the British Parliament to ensure that the provisions of the European Community Treaties, as they then were, and European measures created pursuant to those treaties, would have direct effect in British law. This was needed because Britain adheres to the dualist theory of the relationship between international and domestic law. Britain's entry into treaties creates legal rights and obligations at international law, but a parliamentary statute is required to create corresponding rights in domestic law. The European Communities Act was enacted after Britain signed the Treaty of Accession, but before Britain ratified it. The process recognised the capacity of the Queen to sign the treaty in exercise of her prerogatives without parliamentary approval. But it also recognised the need to postpone Britain's ratification of the treaty until after the European Communities Act was enacted. And this was to ensure that at the time of ratification, Britain would be in compliance with its European obligations. This was achieved because the Act gave automatic and immediate domestic effect to the rights and duties created by the treaties and pursuant to them. And so a large part of the Brexit case concerned the meaning and effect of this Act, the European Communities Act. However, it's important for you to appreciate that there is no section in the Act that explicitly addresses such things as the capacity of the British Crown to exercise the international prerogatives. It just doesn't address the question. And so the question in the Brexit case was whether the Act, nonetheless, in some other indirect way or by implication, had that effect. Now, there are other British statutes that are also in play. There are a series of UK statutes which specifically named each successive European treaty and inserted them into the European Communities Act so that it successively gave effect to the obligations under that succession of treaties. There are also two British statutes which give British citizens rights to vote in elections for the European Parliament and to stand as candidates. And there's the European Union Amendment Act of 2008, which added the Treaty of Lisbon to the list of treaties in the European Communities Act and it did address the prerogative. It provided that UK ministers could not ratify any treaty without parliamentary approval if it altered the competences of the Union, the European Union, or diluted the influence of the member states within the EU. And this Act was then further modified in 2011, which added to those requirements that if any treaty was to make those changes, it would have to be approved in addition by a UK-wide referendum. And so they're the only provisions of British statutes that directly address the prerogatives in relation to Britain's relationship to the European Union. And then, of course, there was the European Union Referendum Act of 2015, which authorised the holding of the referendum that was held in June last year. But importantly, this Act did not stipulate any legal consequences of the referendum result. So what would happen as a consequence of the referendum, whether a yes or a no, a leave or remain, was left to political determination. Now, when we think about addressing the question that was being posed in the Brexit case, there were two competing principles and two, I would propose, competing syllogisms at stake. All of the members of the court accepted the validity of the two underlying principles, and I'll come to them in a moment in detail, but to introduce them in their simplest form, the two principles are, and you should be able to guess it, firstly, that UK ministers exercising the prerogatives of the Crown have the power to enter into and terminate treaties. Nobody doubts that. The second principle is that ministers of the Crown exercising the prerogatives do not have the power to make changes to British law when it's in the form of statutes enacted by the Parliament or indeed the common law. Now, two things, though, need to be noted about both those principles. Firstly, as I've mentioned, the United Kingdom follows the dualist theory of the relationship between domestic and international law. This means that when the UK enters a treaty, this only creates obligations at international law and no rights will be created in domestic law without a parliamentary statute. That shapes the way these principles work and how they relate to each other, as we'll see in a minute. Secondly, both principles are subject to any Act of Parliament that provides to the contrary. So, the power of ministers to enter into treaties or withdraw from them can be controlled by the Parliament if the Parliament does so clearly in a statute. And secondly, Parliament can authorise ministers to exercise powers that result in changes to UK law. So it's quite a complicated set of principles that interrelate here. Now, recall that the issue in the Brexit case concerned the requirements of UK law for the giving of notice under Article 50. Ordinarily, the giving of such notice under an international treaty would clearly fall within the prerogatives. So if we put all these principles together, though, the question in the case becomes this: whether that acknowledged power of the prerogative power to give notice has been either prohibited or controlled by a parliamentary statute, or would, if it was exercised, have the effect of changing British law. And they were the central questions in the case. Now, if you want to turn to those two syllogisms that should be on the second page that I've given you, to me this is my best effort to reconstruct the logic of the decision. And as a common lawyer, I suppose I'm trying to think like a civilian here. I don't know if that's very successful, but we'll see. So you can see that major premise A, fully constructed, says this: the Crown has the prerogative power to give notice under Article 50 unless it is abrogated or regulated expressly or impliedly by a statute enacted by the Parliament. Now, the primary argument of the British government arguing for the prerogative was that the European Communities Act, as well as all those other acts that I mentioned, do not expressly or impliedly abrogate or regulate the Crown's powers in this respect. And so this led to the conclusion, the government argued, that the Crown, acting of course on the advice of the government, continues to have an unabrogated and unregulated prerogative power to give notice under Article 50. The competing syllogism led, however, in a totally different direction. It began with the major premise that, as you can see, the Crown cannot exercise its prerogative powers to change the law or abrogate rights enacted by the Parliament unless, of course, this is authorised by an Act of Parliament. The applicants in the case, Gina Miller and Dos Santos, argued, well, they actually had to argue for quite a few minor premises, and I'm not sure that this has been clear in the discussion I've seen of the case so far. But logically, it seems to me that in terms of trying to get to their conclusion, they had to establish three separate minor premises. The first one being that the laws and rights created by or under the European treaties and given effect by the European Communities Act are, in the relevant sense, laws and rights enacted by the Parliament. And I'll come back to that, because you might think they obviously are, but it's not so clear. They also had to establish that an exercise by the Crown of its prerogative powers to give notice under Article 50 would, in effect, change the law and abrogate those rights. And they further had to establish that neither the European Communities Act or any of the other acts authorise the exercise of the prerogative to do so. According to the applicants, as it was initially argued in the case, they could establish all of these minor premises, and thus it followed that the Crown cannot exercise its prerogatives to give notice under Article 50 unless some special subsequent or some special act is enacted by the Parliament to authorise it to do so. So, standing back from the case, are these syllogisms logically valid and legally correct? And if they are both correct, which one of them is to prevail? Because here we have the prospect of two arguments, both well-founded upon accepted principles of UK law, which lead to contradictory conclusions. And this obviously creates a dilemma. We encounter an aporia. We hesitate before the two alternative conclusions, and we're not sure which one to choose. Indeed, the case came before the UK Supreme Court as an appeal from two decisions that were brought down. One decided in Northern Ireland, which held that the first syllogism applied and governed the case, and another one decided in England and Wales, which held that the second syllogism applied. In face of this dilemma, however, the UK Supreme Court wasn't hesitant. By a majority of 8-3, it held in favour of the applicants, that in order for the UK government to give notice under Article 50, an authorising statute would be required. However, even though the court held in favour of the applicants, its reasoning did not involve a simple application of the syllogism I've just described. Or at least, the application of those syllogisms proved to be more complex and difficult than might have been expected. Let me try and explain why. The first syllogism, as I've called it, the first problem concerned syllogism A. The problem here for the applicants was that, as I noted earlier, the European Communities Act in no place expressly addresses the prerogative, let alone regulates or controls it. And it's very difficult to establish that the Act in this had this effect by even necessary implication. It was only the Acts of 2008 and 2011 that ever addressed the prerogative powers, as I've mentioned. But these Acts, as I've explained, were limited to particular circumstances. And so when the Parliament addressed its mind to the question of the prerogatives, it did those particular things and it left alone the prerogative relating to withdrawal from the treaties. As a consequence, the applicants recognised that they had a problem with syllogism A. If it governs the case, then their arguments could be doomed to failure. The applicants therefore directed their efforts to syllogism B in two ways. First, to establish that syllogism B was logically valid, and second, to establish that it prevailed over syllogism A, because you had to decide between the two. But to establish the validity of it, they had to establish each of those three minor premises, and it's more difficult than it appears to do so. And what is really striking about the Supreme Court's decision is that in resolving the question, it didn't, in my view, follow the submissions of the parties, but approached the question in a somewhat radically different way that avoided the difficulties that the applicants faced in establishing these syllogisms. Let me explain. So if you have a look at minor premise B1, you can see it in the handout. The difficulty in establishing that concerned the usual way in which the European Communities Act gives domestic effect to EU law. And I'll bring up on the screen the text of section 2.1 of the European Communities Act. It's a dreadful piece of drafting. Look at it. Now, I've tried to put in bold the core logic of the section. And I'll just read those words. All rights from time to time created or arising by or under the treaties, jump down, shall be recognised and available in law and be enforced, allowed and followed accordingly. Very clumsy language. It must have been amended a few times. I've not looked at the legislative history of the Act. But that's what it provides. So the question in the case was whether the rights to which Section 2.1 refers are, quote, rights enacted by the Parliament in the relevant sense. But you see, Section 2.1 doesn't enact rights in any straightforward sense. It rather assumes the existence of certain rights. Notice in the text of the section, rights created or arising by or under the treaties. And it provides that these shall be recognised and available in the law. And note that it refers to these rights as arising from time to time. So it's not possible to know the content of the rights by reading the Act alone. The content of the rights depends on the treaties and the measures created by European institutions. The Act does not identify and does not control the content of the rights to which it gives domestic effect. Are rights like this enacted by Parliament, in a simple sense? Or more to the point, and bearing in mind the UK's dualist approach to domestic and international law, are these rights properly within the sphere of the Parliament's control over domestic law, or are they more in the nature of international law, if we can regard European law in that way for this purpose, and therefore within the sphere of the government's relationship to international law through the prerogative? Or to put it as Professor John Finnis did, EU law and EU rights depend on two conditions for its existence in Britain: action by the government on the international plane and action by the Parliament on the domestic plane. On this view, It is within the jurisdiction of the government both to enter such treaties and to withdraw from them. And this is no breach of the principle that the prerogative cannot be used to abrogate domestic law, because EU law is not domestic law. It's a special kind of international law, or if you like, supranational law. So that was the problem with the minor premise, B1, for the applicants. And it's a problem that gives rise to the view that it's not syllogism B that should be dispositive of the case, but rather syllogism A. That would mean the applicants would lose. This argument, in fact, I think, persuaded a minority of the Supreme Court to decide in favour of the government, Lords Reid, Hughes and Carnwath. However, a majority of the court, led by Lord Newburger, devised a way to avoid this problem. The majority of the court found in favour of the applicants by circumventing the dualist theory of the relationship between UK law and EU law. The court did not expressly reject dualism. In fact, the majority expressly affirmed it. Indeed, according to the majority, dualism is the reason why the two fundamental propositions at stake in the case are compatible, because they operate in different spheres. But the problem is, from the perspective of which sphere of operation, domestic or international, is the act of giving notice under Article 50 to be understood? Dualism leads to the conclusion that it's to be understood from the perspective, as I've said, of the international sphere, the sphere of the government's prerogative. But if that is so, major premise A will prevail. So the court had to find some way around this to circumvent that dualistic logic. And what they did was this. They emphasised the constitutionally unprecedented nature of the system of European law inaugurated by the European Communities Act. Here they pointed out that through the Act, EU law becomes a, and this was important, they said it many times, a source of UK law. And not only that, but also that it takes precedence over all domestic sources of UK law, including statutes. Now, while the majority said that the Act did something constitutionally unprecedented, it's important to note that they insisted that the basic constitutional principles of parliamentary sovereignty were not disturbed. The European Communities Act could still be amended or repealed by the Parliament. So when they talk of the Act having a constitutional significance, they don't mean that it's in the nature of a written constitution that can't be repealed by the Parliament. It's more that the Act introduced into the UK a body of EU law that takes precedence over domestic law, including parliamentary statutes, even those enacted in the future. And in this sense, they say, the Act has a constitutional character. Now, looking at it this way, the majority considered that the most fundamental and realistic way of understanding the European Communities Act was that it turned European law into a direct source of UK law and an independent overriding source of domestic law. And this move of bringing EU law into the framework of UK law was very important, because it moved the question of the domain from international law into the domain of domestic law, the domain in which parliamentary sovereignty rather than international prerogatives of the Crown operates. And so the majority insisted that, although the content of EU law is exclusively a question of EU law and what the European Court of Justice says it is, when we look at the process by which that becomes domestic law in the UK, the court describes this as a, quote, new constitutional process for making law in the United Kingdom. And you see how then it brings it into domestic law and under the sovereignty of Parliament. This was very clever. Analysing it this way, the majority were able to acknowledge, as John Finnis had argued, and counsel for the government had submitted, that the operation of EU law depends on the two conditions, the treaty and the statute. But by characterising the question as a domestic constitutional one, in this special sense, they could still conclude that the giving of notice under Article 50 would have to be authorised by a statute passed by Parliament. And this is the way they put it. The prerogative cannot be used to make, quote, fundamental changes to the constitutional arrangements of the United Kingdom. So in that sense, not only did they bring EU law as a source of law into domestic law, but they said that it transformed the nature of domestic law, broke down the barrier, as it were, and became part of the constitution of the United Kingdom in this middle level sense. And this could explain why major premise A, the big problem for the applicants, didn't apply to the case because of this transformation of domestic law. And interestingly, its integration into the EU system of law. Reflecting on it, I want to put it this way, that the EU treaties now have an organic relationship to domestic law because they have become constituent elements of the UK constitution. And so it takes a statute by the Parliament to change the constitution back again. The prerogative is not sufficient to do that. And this is a question of domestic constitutional law. Now, it seems to me that is a breathtaking line of reasoning. And it brings me at last to the outsider perspective that I'd like to share with you this evening. For interestingly, it has turned out that the Supreme Court's resolution of the Brexit case has turned not simply on the well-established traditions of UK constitutional law, but on the unique and unprecedented nature of the European Union as a kind of constitutional order and supranational system that's nevertheless founded on a series of international treaties. And this brings into play a topic that I and Professor Bob have spent a lot of time thinking about the nature of federations and about, for me, what makes them different from international organisations on one hand and unitary states on the other. Now, it's commonplace to distinguish these types of political system on a spectrum or a continuum, with international organisations at one end and unitary states at the other, and with confederations, federations and devolutionary systems somewhere in between. This makes sense, but we need to ask what exactly does the difference between these systems consist? In what does it consist? And here I think it's important to look very closely at the constitutional assumptions and legal processes according to which each kind of system is brought into being. A unitary state, according to prevailing liberal democratic theory, rests upon a hypothesised social contract entered into by a particular group of people. While the theory proposes conceptually that every individual person consents to the formation of the political community, once the community is formed, its typical mode of decision-making is by majority vote. At the other end of the spectrum, an international organisation is formed by a treaty between independent states, and the basic decision-making rule is not majority, it's unanimity. Each and every member state individually agrees to the formation of the international organisation. And the European Union has this quality. It was formed by the agreement of each and every member state. And every amending treaty has required the unanimous consent of every state. EU laws may be made through processes that involve qualified majorities, but that is because each and every member state has agreed to that process. But what's important to note, and something that I've emphasised, I take Professor Bolderby emphasising this too, integrated federations and confederations have this quality as well. They are classically formed by the agreement between each and every member state. But the interesting thing about them is that they also provide in their constitutions for lawmaking processes that depend upon majority rule. But if this is so, what makes an international organisation different from a confederation, different from a federation? Because they seem to be the same at this fundamental level. Here it's important to look at the special decision-making rules that are adopted for the amendment of the founding document of the system and for the withdrawal of member states from it. International organisations and confederations, and I think the EU is a prime example, typically provide that for the amendment of the arrangement, the consent of each and every member state is required. And while it is a matter of dispute for a long time, the Lisbon Treaty has further provided, as we know, this is why we have the Brexit case, that each member state has in effect a unilateral right to withdraw from the EU, subject of course to the conditions in Article 50. Similar claims are routinely made in confederations, that each member state entered the confederation by an exercise of its own will and it retains the right to judge whether the other parties have fulfilled their obligations under the confederation, and it retains the unilateral right to withdraw from the confederation if it judges that this is the appropriate action to take. The very same claim, though, was made by the secessionist states of the United States of America in the period leading up to the Civil War, and it was also made by secessionist cantons in Switzerland. However, both the United States and Switzerland are considered to be federations, not confederations. Some cynical people would say that what makes them federations is a result of realpolitik and the Civil War. The forces of the centre in each case forced the secessionist states to remain part of the Union. However, when you look at the amendment formulas in the constitutions of federations, they're quite different from what you find in Article 50 of the TEU. While federal constitutions cannot usually be amended by a simple majority of people, nor do they require the unanimous consent of all the member states. So when a member state agrees to form a federation or join a federation, it commits itself to a constitutional destiny and potential constitutional changes over which it has relinquished control, even though it continues to have a say in that decision, because unanimity tends not to be the rule of amendment. And that is what makes federations different from confederations, in my view. They're both founded on the unanimous consent of the member states, but in a confederation, the rule of unanimity is retained for the amendment of the constitution, whereas in a federation, there's a movement towards a qualified majority. Understood in this context, the European Union looks a lot like a confederation. But this analysis raises another important question. When a federal-like political system is formed, when it's amended, and when a member state withdraws from membership, according to which system of law is the act of formation, the act of amendment, and the act of withdrawal to be understood? Because it was this question that really was at the heart of the Brexit case. You see, although Article 50 pointedly says that each member state determines whether it intends to withdraw in accordance with its constitutional requirements, when the Supreme Court sought to identify the requirements of UK law for the giving of notice, it cleverly bypassed the dualist theory of the UK's relationship to the EU. And it did so, as I've said, by saying that the European Communities Act drew the UK into a unique supranational constitutional system which breaks down the barriers between domestic and international law. Thus, the court says that the EU lawmaking institutions have in effect become sources of UK domestic law. And by becoming part of the domestic system, they've in fact transformed it from within, integrating it into the European Union system. It's a negative metaphor, but it's a bit like a Trojan horse or a bit like a virus, transforming the host. It doesn't necessarily mean I think it's negative, but that sort of is a vivid image of what happened. Thus, the court says that EU lawmaking institutions have in effect become sources of UK law and transformed it from in, creating this organic relationship. As the court put it, and here's a quote from the court, it created a dynamic international source of law that was grafted onto and above the well-established existing sources of domestic law. So when we look back at the case, we can say this. While the UK Constitution was not changed in its fundamentals, Parliament is still sovereign, it was changed. And that's the intriguing paradox of the Supreme Court's decision in the Brexit case. And interestingly, it seems to me, much the same issue was at stake in the transformation of the US Federation after the Civil War. From a federation in which each state exercised its own judgment about the constitutional validity of federal action, to a federation in which the judgments of the federal institutions of government, the President, the Congress, and the Supreme Court will prevail. So what conclusions can we draw from all of this? And I'll be brief. The first is that very complex and fascinating issues arise when federations and special international organisations like the EU are brought into existence. Conflicts emerge over the meaning and interpretation of the relevant treaties and constitutions that establish the arrangement, and deep questions arise about which system of law and from which institutional perspective judgments are to be made and actions are to be taken. Article 50 shows that the EU treaties not only recognise a unilateral right of each member state to withdraw from the Union, but that the legal processes by which any such decision to withdraw is made is a question of domestic constitutional law for the member state. It's not a constitutional question for the European Union. However, the Supreme Court's decision in the Brexit case seems to have subverted this in subtle ways. For in their reasoning, when the UK enacted the European Communities Act, it not only brought EU law into UK domestic law at the level of the specific rules and remedies of EU law, but at a constitutional level as well. And as I said, this is a breathtaking conclusion. Whether it's the right conclusion, or whether the dissenting judges more faithfully decided the case, quote, in accordance with the constitutional requirements of the United Kingdom, close quote, as Article 50 requires, is something we should ponder. Thank you.